Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. My guest today is a knight, an actual knight. He is a professed member of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta and the only Maltese to have ever been elevated to the highest ranks of this international order. For several years, he lived in the order's headquarters at the historic Palazzo Malta in Rome, where he was conservator of the Magistral Palace Library and Archives, as well as curator of the art collections of the order. In 2000, he moved to Malta to take up residence at St. Angelo, where to this day he is the only knight resident occupying and caring for this incredible site, which is laden with history and overlooks the Grand Harbour of Malta. He has been received into various orders of chivalry and honoured with the award of several prestigious decorations from various states. He wears all this very lightly, and his warmth and charm, his welcoming nature and a charitable disposition are what one always remembers after meeting him. Fra John Edward Crittin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Francesca. I think I've known you so long that if you just call me John, I'd be happier.
Fra John to you. You are the only Maltese to have ever been elevated to the rank of Knight Grand Cross of Justice, and subsequently to that of Bailiff Grand Cross of Justice. What do these grades actually mean, and how do they distinguish you from the several other worthy Maltese gentlemen and ladies who are also members of the order?
Yes, let me try and explain what distinguishes me from the other gentlemen and ladies who are members of the order. Thank you for using the adjective worthy gentlemen and ladies who are members of the order. Indeed, they are. What would we be without them? I think what really distinguishes me from the other members of the order on the island is that I have taken religious vows in the order. Let us first of all remember that the order is a Roman Catholic order. Some members in this order decide, or perhaps the Lord decides for them, to take vows, religious vows, the same religious vows one takes in any other religious order of the Church, poverty, chastity, and obedience. Others are not tied by religious vows. Obviously, they're Roman Catholics. Obviously, they lead, we hope, exemplary lives. But they're not tied in any way by vows or promises of any sort. So I think that in a few words is what distinguishes me, first of all, from the other members of the order on the island. Two things I wish to add here. One is that I'm not the first Maltese Knight of Justice. There have been a handful of Knights of Justice over the centuries, but none of them, and here you're absolutely right, has ever had the privilege of becoming a Knight Grand Cross of Justice, and after that, a Bailiff Grand Cross of Justice. So yes, this is quite exceptional, I would say, but having been in vows, or having been in a Knight of Justice since 1993, or perhaps, yes, 1993, then I suppose one expects to sort of go forward in the ranks of the order, and fortunately, two Grand Masters, Grand Master Barty first and Grand Master Festing after him, elevated me, the former, to a Grand Cross of Justice, the latter to a Bailiff Grand Cross of Justice. It's an honorary title. Bailiff is an honorary title. In the past, it was associated with positions one held in the order. Nowadays, it's just an honorary title and the highest title the order can give any of its members.
The Order of St. John was set up almost 1,000 years ago as a hospitaller order and evolved into a temporal power, enjoying sovereignty, its own army and great riches and land. But its role has changed through the centuries. What is the Order of St. John's role nowadays, and is it still a sovereign state?
I would say that the current role of the Order is exactly the same role the Order had when it was founded 1,000 years ago. The Order started as a hospitaller order, became a religious order, was obliged to take up arms, so it became a military order to defend its properties, to defend the pilgrims on their way to the Holy Land or on their way to Rome, on their way to Santiago de Compostela. It became a sovereign order, in other words, its complete independence from other temporary powers was recognized by the pontiffs, first of all, and by other European rulers. Now the whole circle has sort of moved round, and we've returned to what we were in the origin. In other words, we dedicate all our time, to hospitaller works and assistential works, where we can intervene to make life easier for those who have unfortunately lived unhappier lives than we have, let's put it like that.
From the political point of view, though, is it a sovereign state as such?
I wouldn't call it a state, because I identify a state with land, territory, and with citizens. And the Order has neither land or territory, nor citizens. Although I must sort of point out here that during recent years, it has become customary for the Order to give citizenship to the members of Sovereign Council for the duration of their charge on Sovereign Council. For example, I was a member of Sovereign Council on two occasions for two mandates, and during the second mandate, 2014-2019, on my diplomatic passport of the Order, where it says nationality, I had Sovereign Military Order of Malta. When I dropped out of Sovereign Council in 2019, in other words, when I wasn't re-elected for the next mandate, another diplomatic passport was issued to me, in which, under nationality, I reverted to my old nationality, my current nationality, Maltese nationality. So, in actual fact, we cover that condition, let's put it like that. But territory, no, we have no territory.
Property, yes, though.
Property, yes. Fortunately, yes. I say fortunately because without our properties, in Italy more than anywhere else, I think it would be impossible for us to carry out most of the works we carry out. I mean, property means income, and income means spending on our hospitaller works.
But the property itself doesn't have its own self-determining rules. It isn't like the Vatican, which is a state in its own right within Rome and within Italy.
Well, I mean, we have our code, we have our tribunals, we have our postage stamps, we have our diplomatic passports, our car number plates. We are recognized as a sovereign entity by 130 countries all over the world.
But you're subject to Italian law within the palazzo.
Subject to Italian law to a certain extent, in that if we have Italian employees, and in Rome at the center all our employees are Italian, then we are subject to Italian laws of employment and so on.
I see. You don't have diplomatic immunity, for example?
No, not exactly. No, the Grand Master certainly has, the Grand Chancellor too. To some extent, the members of government, the members of sovereign order, of the sovereign council. But no, not just any member of the order, certainly not.
It's very ad hoc, sort of.
Exactly.
Not quite the San Marino case, not quite the Vatican case, but it's got its own.
Not exactly, no. But it enjoys these sovereign prerogatives and is recognized as such, as I said, by about 130 countries with whom we have an exchange of ambassadors, I mean, including Malta, Italy, the Holy See. We are permanent observers at the United Nations in New York, so sovereignty is recognized. And sovereignty is very important, not only because it's sovereignty, the order's a sovereign order and all that. Sovereignty means a way of making our works in certain parts of the world so much easier. In other words, where other countries can't intervene, the sovereign order can, because it has
neutral
relations, because it's recognized as being entirely neutral, and so on and so forth.
So throughout your life's journey, your many abilities have been appreciated, and you have held several high positions within the order. But in recent years, the order has been in the international news as a result of the papacy not quite seeing eye to eye with it. In the same period, some high positions were vacated and you were selected as a trusted and safe hand to take up these positions and to help ensure that the order could move forward out of that impasse. In a nutshell, what happened?
I think all that happened was the result of misunderstandings between the Order and the Holy See. I think I can only add that the whole affair was mismanaged. I would say mismanaged on both sides. True, some high positions were vacated. Also true that I suddenly found myself as Grand Chancellor ad interim in the Order, which is a position I never aspired to and wasn't happy about at all. But on the other hand, I also have a vow of obedience as a professed member, as a Knight of Justice, and so since Sovereign Council decided to co-opt me Grand Chancellor, I just had to bow my head and accept the position of Grand Chancellor. A very delicate moment. I think I didn't sort of maneuver things badly during the 3 months I was Grand Chancellor ad interim. But after 3 months, the Holy See again intervened and decided that one person who had been sort of kicked aside had to be reinstated. And if that person had to be reinstated, I had to sort of step down and allow him to be reinstated. No problem with me. Very glad to get back to my previous and current positions of curator of the art collections and so on and so forth. But it was a very eventful period. The actual difficulties haven't quite been solved yet. But I'm confident and happy that I think very shortly some sort of agreements may be reached, and our famous constitutional charter and code, which we were expected to revise by the Holy See, will actually be revised, or the revision will be completed, and things will return to normal. But things are certainly much better than they were when I had taken over as Grand Chancellor.
Let's talk about St. Angelo. You live on hallowed ground. As Knight Resident of the upper part of Fort St. Angelo, an area which incidentally had been ceded to the Order for a 99-year period by the government of Malta, you are the sole person to continue in a centuries-old tradition. And let's not forget that Fort St. Angelo was the headquarters of the Order during the Great Siege of 1565, and this battle unfolded and saw its bloodiest moments right below and around St. Angelo. So, as you look over the battlements today, Fra John, you are standing where Grand Master de Valette and his knights would have stood, anxiously observing the Ottoman advance in those heated days of the siege in summer 1565. What does it feel like to live and take care of such an important monument?
Well, that's a good question, Francesca. Yes, in the past, I suppose, de Valette and his knights anxiously awaited the arrival of the incursors, the Ottomans, the invaders. I still keep watch, but fortunately no longer, on possible invaders, or perhaps the invasion of tourists to the place. But I think we'll speak about that later on. How do I feel about this? Well, the position of Knight Resident at Fort St. Angelo also came as a surprise to me. I mean, I was called to Grand Master's office, and at the time it was Fra Andrew Barty, and I walked into his office and he said, "John, how would you feel if I were to ask you to go to Malta to run Fort St. Angelo?" And I was taken aback and replied, "Your Highness, what do you mean, run Fort St. Angelo?" And he raised his eyes to heaven, as he would do when people asked him questions, and said, John, run it. So I said, good, that's a wonderful carta bianca. I can do what I like. So I said, Your Highness, may I sort of think about it? After all, I had been living in Italy when this question was put to me for about 25 years, even longer, perhaps. So I said, let me please allow me to sleep over it. I'll come back to you tomorrow. I went back to his office the day after, and before going into his office, I remembered his words to me on previous occasions when we discussed the vow of obedience. Mm-hmm. And I remember Fra Andrew saying, in a nutshell, the vow of obedience is trying to interpret what your superior desires. In other words, don't actually wait for the order, for the command, but try and interpret what he wishes. So I thought, if the Grand Master is asking me how would I feel if I were to be asked, obviously he would like me to go and run Fort St. Angelo. So I told him, I'm quite happy to run Fort St. Angelo if you think this is what you like. And
was it in shambles at the time?
Well, our part of the fort, I mean the part assigned to us by the government of Malta, had been more or less restored, but I mean, I've been carrying on restoration work since then for the last 20 years, so it wasn't actually quite ready to take a resident, but I was happy to be there. Family was informed in Malta. They were very surprised when I told them I'm going to live in Birgu, and when they asked where exactly, I said, Fort St. Angelo. They said, Fort St. Angelo, you must be mad. I said, well, not exactly, but it's a challenge. So I'm always happy to start a new chapter in my life, and this was another chapter in my life. So
I remember visiting you in the early 2000s. You had already started to restore the place, yes. And you were living there. You had been living for a few years. But it was quite scary to actually arrive at it. Once you were within your walls, it was absolutely fine. But there were squatters outside your walls, and it was it was an area which was quite derelict.
It was open to all, let's put it like that. There was meant to be a watchman at the bottom of the fort, but the watchman never seemed to be there. So people sort of drove in, drove out, walked in, walked out at all times of day and all times of night. And, okay, I was prepared for everything. I'm quite an adventurous person myself and accepted the situation. But then there was one particular moment in which I was a little annoyed, because I found that the chapel below our area, the chapel, so-called Chapel of the Nativity, had been broken into. And there were, let's say, upturned candles and candles on the floor and bits of cotton wool with blood stains on them. So I thought, something is going wrong. So I said, this can't go on. So I spoke to government about it, and government appreciated the situation and immediately reversed the orders and made sure that the place was well guarded and looked after, and has been since then, thank
God. Yes, and then of course there was the great restoration of that was undertaken some years ago by Heritage Malta, and now it's open to the public. But going back to the Great Siege and all that unfolded around St. Angelo, have you ever read the eyewitness account of the Siege of Malta, which was written by a foot soldier who was participating in it, a certain Balbi da Correggio? And this eyewitness account was translated in 1961. It was written in Spanish. It was translated into English by Henry Alexander Balbi. And it was an account, a day-by-day account of all that was unfolding around St. Angelo at the time, the battle happening.
I think you've mentioned one of two books which I always recommend to not only scholars, but students, anyone interested in the Great Siege, and everyone seems to be interested in the Great Siege. One is the Balbi di Correggio book you mentioned, and the second is The Great Siege by Ernest Bradford,
which is also a translation, but it's slightly different.
But another bestseller for anyone interested in the Great Siege. How do I feel? Well, it's very awe-inspiring when you're on your own up there, as I am at certain times of day, and you feel you're walking on land which Knights and soldiers stood on and fought and lost their lives and prayed in the chapel and so on. I think you used an expression, hallowed ground.
Yes.
That is something I like using myself a lot with reference to St. Angelo, where someone suggests organizing something a little too daring, in my opinion, for Fort St. Angelo. I say, let us remember that this is hallowed ground. I mean, this is the place which saved the island, I mean, together with Birgu, together with Senglia, and so on, but it has to be respected. I mean, there is a burial site for people who, knights, Maltese soldiers, etc., who fought hand in hand with the knights during the Great Siege, after all, who are actually buried there. I think the place has to be given the respect it is due. And I find that visitors to the fort actually appreciate that we try to keep the place as quiet, as hallowed, as...
It's a bit of a shrine to the great...
A bit of a shrine, I think that's right, yes, that's right.
And we spoke about the spirit of place in a previous podcast when we had Richard England on as a guest. And spirit of place kept coming up. It's, in a way, even the emotions and the events that unfolded are somehow captured in those stones. And this memory is somehow transmitted even to modern day people. I certainly feel it when I walk into St. Angelo. There is a hush, perhaps, but there is something, some reverberation.
Well, certainly the hush, Francesca. It's possibly the only quiet place on the island nowadays. So. The hush in itself comes as a surprise and as a welcome surprise to visitors. So, yes, it does have an effect on you.
Yeah, this is a very
early in the morning, when the sun is rising, and I don't often see that. But at sunset as well is a particular moment when you really feel you have the sun shining into the door of the Chapel of St. Anne. It's magnificent. It is really a very, very special place. I feel very privileged to live there. I mean, it has its difficulties, of course, as you can imagine, but difficulties one is very happy to accept, I mean, having the privilege to live in this very special place and on one's own. This is wonderful.
In fact, under your watch, you actually had a lot of restoration going on to bring it up to scratch and to obviously restore its dignity to it. What buildings actually lie on the site, which is part of the Order's reserve?
As you know, we own on a temporary basis, obviously. I mean, the land, the fort belongs to the people of Malta. But a certain area of the fort, the top sector of the fort, was given to us in use for 99 years by the government of Malta on condition that we restore it, that we make it as accessible as possible to the public, and that we carry out some of our activities from there. I mean, nowadays, I carry out some of our activities from there. The buildings included in our sector of the fort are the main buildings of the fort. I mean, the chapel dedicated to St. Anne, and the magistral palace, the first magistral palace on the island, and, of course, the famous Nymphaeum or grotto in the garden, which is a delightful part of the fort, because it's the only building which wasn't ever utilized for military purposes or religious purposes. It's just a shady spot. That's all it is. It's positioned in such a way that the sun never shines inside this sort of grotto or nymphaeum. And it was built in 1530, 1531, immediately the knights got here. And obviously they felt the need to create a corner, a cool corner for poor Grand Master de la Dame. He must have found the heat of Malta extremely shocking when he got here.
But also so decorative and beautiful, and
it's very beautiful,
in line with Renaissance architecture.
And it's the first example of Renaissance architecture on the island, with its coffered ceiling and barrel vaulted coffered ceiling, which we see so often in palaces and churches in Malta, but that's the prototype, the first example on the island, so it's a very special place. I have two nephews who call it disrespectfully Grandmaster Lilladam's chill-out place.
You've always been remarkably generous in opening your doors to worthy causes, and you've established an excellent rapport with the people of Birgu in particular. Birgu is the city at the foot of St. Angelo, but beyond the walls of St. Angelo. You're even honorary president of the St. Lawrence Band Club of Birgu. Do you feel an affinity or even a responsibility to work closely with the people of Birgu?
Well, the moment I got here in 2000, somehow I realized that the people of Birgu weren't very happy that Fort St. Angelo, or part of it at least, had been given to the Knights of Malta, and I thought perhaps it was my duty to try and remedy the situation. First of all, I realized very soon that the actual fact that the Knight resident was Maltese already helped to break the ice between the order on Fort St. Angelo and the town of Birgu. That helped to a great extent. Then I thought the best way to go about it is to invite the people of Birgu to come and see Fort St. Angelo. It was shortly before Christmas, so I had an open house for the people of Birgu with drinks and small eats flowing. And after that, I think I've never had any problems with the people of Birgu. I think they took a liking to me. I certainly took a liking to them. In fact, my family owns a small flat in Birgu, which was acquired especially for my needs, should I ever have to leave Fort St. Angelo. And I think it will be a place I would love to live in, if I ever have to leave Fort St. Angelo. I get it very well. I get on very well with them. I try to help as much as I can. I take part in as many activities as I can. I mean, the religious ceremonies and all that. And I even got involved. I mean, very soon after arriving, the St. Lawrence Band Club decided to make me honorary president. I thought this was a great honor and enjoyed it, and still do. Perhaps I don't go as often as I should, but I'm getting old, and walking down from the fort is a little more of an effort now than it was 20 years ago.
Well, your heart is certainly in Birgu.
Absolutely, yes, no doubt about that. It's wonderful to walk in the streets of Birgu and in the main piazza of Birgu, and to be greeted by someone with a very sort of friendly, "Au, Fra!" and sort of, "Do you need anything? If you need anything, let us know."
They have your back. They're watching us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, they're very, very up to date with what I do. Right.
You have to pass through Birgu to get to Fort St. Angelo anyway.
Absolutely.
But another place your heart is, in art. Your love of art, particularly of the decorative arts, is no secret to anyone. And you are most definitely a connoisseur of the objet d'art. Now, when did this love of beautiful objects start, and what triggered it?
What triggered my love for objet d'art? I think my mother. My mother had a certain love for these sort of things, and my father wasn't interested. My father was only interested in maps and engravings and views of Malta and things like that. My mother and I were very different and liked knick-knacks and little bits of silver and small paintings. And anyway, completely different. But I think her education as such certainly helped to instill in me at a very early age a love of what I'm particularly interested in now.
Let's take a break and then we'll come back to delve deeper into our relationship with the arts.
This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, curator and Knight of Malta, Fra John Cretin.
And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Fra John, one of the more niche areas of the decorative arts that you're particularly interested in is antique Chinese ceramics. Why Chinese ceramics in particular?
I think this is linked to my childhood as well. There were, alongside the fireplace where I lived as a child, two Canton vases which belonged to my mother. Very stupidly, placed on the floor on each side of the fireplace. As a child, I often played. We had very little to play with at the time, but anyway, my little dinky toys, my little toy cars and all that, lying on the floor in front of the fireplace. And once I kicked one of her Canton vases over, and of course, it
was broken.
Hundreds of pieces. So there was a very early connection with Chinese ceramics. Another sort of thing which takes me back to my childhood is two Chinese plates, again Canton, which belonged to my grandmother, and somehow the fact that these sort of pieces came from so far away, so, I mean, something I only, perhaps at the time, I only knew about the Great Wall of China or something like that. But anyway, I found them fascinating, and that's not really what set off the passion for Chinese ceramics. What happened is that in 1984, when I was curator of the art collections of the order, we had a very generous bequest from a certain Countess Valeria Rossi di Montelera. When I speak about Rossi here, I mean Martini e Rossi, so you can imagine the possibilities the Contessa had in acquiring works of art. She left her collection of ceramics, her collection of books, silver, paintings, silver, all the furnishings of her palace in Rome, to the order. And as curator, I had to sort of write an inventory of what was left to us. I suddenly found myself faced with boxes of Chinese ceramics, porcelain, if you wish, on which I knew very, very little. And so what does one do in that situation? One sort of starts acquiring books, studying, and taking a serious interest before writing nonsense on the inventories and all that. And the same thing happened with our collection of books, our collection of book bindings. When I finally finished cataloguing the paintings, furniture, and so on and so forth, the only boxes left to open were books, which I thought I would leave to the end, because I was more interested in the other objects than books. When I opened the first box, I realized that these were books with a difference. These books were pieces of art. I mean, the covers they had in leather, inlaid leather, were something incredible. And so, again, one opens the book and finds that there's an actual signature of the bookbinder. One sort of leaves through the book and finds there are engravings, and the first run of the engraving, the second run of the engraving, third, fourth, all within the same book. The actual drawing of the artist before the picture became an engraving. And so this opened up another great interest, book bindings. Again, one had to buy as many books as possible on fine book bindings and learn as much as possible in a short period of time to be able to go on with the job of creating the inventories. I think, thanks to the Valeria Rossi di Montelera bequest, that I took a great interest in book bindings and in Chinese ceramics.
And that puts me in mind of two splendid exhibitions that you put on at St. Angelo. In fact, you've put on quite a number of exhibitions abroad, but in Malta in particular, I remember the thrilling exhibition of fine book bindings from the National Library that you had organized with Joseph Sciro and Maroma Camilleri. And then some years later, you had organized another exhibition at the Magistral Palace at St. Angelo, which this time focused on antique Chinese ceramics. They were beautiful exhibitions and an opportunity to see them on the backdrop of the Magistral Palace.
Well, the whole idea was to make the palace a little more accessible to the public, so I thought I had to find a way of attracting visitors. And since I had dedicated so much time to studying the two subjects, I mean, book bindings and Chinese ceramics, I mean, Maroma Camilleri and Joe Sciro were good friends of mine. They still are. And obviously I spoke to them about it, and they were both enthusiastic and said, we have fantastic book bindings at the National Library in Malta. And so I said, wonderful. Let's try and do something together. So we did. We worked on it, and I drove down from Rome to Malta carrying cases of books from the Magistral Palace Library in Rome, especially for the exhibition.
Gosh, what a responsibility.
Yes, quite a responsibility, especially when I remember Daniel Gera de Petri Testaverata flew up to Rome and said, I'll accompany you down, which is always very kind of him and all that. And we drove down, and it took us much less time than we thought, and we just slept in the car in the port of, I don't remember where it was, one of the, anyway, where we'd catch the ferry to Malta. We later discovered it was the least safe place to park a car or minivan full of priceless works of art, but we slept with them, so it was all
beyond the call of duty.
Yes.
Curators normally have to accompany works of art, but not sleep with them.
When we actually decided on the second exhibition, which was Chinese ceramics, first of all, some people raised eyebrows and immediately said, what's the connection between Chinese ceramics and the Order of Malta?
But there is.
But there is a connection in that we have a good collection of Chinese ceramics, but it stops there. I mean,
but aren't some made as exports for knights?
Yes.
With our Maurice bearings?
You're right. While I studied the ceramics, I discovered that some knights of Malta actually ordered their dinner services in China with their coats of arms painted on, because they discovered, like many other members of the European nobility, that it was cheaper to have them painted in China than in the then modern European ceramics or porcelain factories of Dresden and so on and so forth. And so an enormous quantity of porcelain was made especially on commission and for the European market. Anyway, another part of the bequest, as I said, was the fabulous collection of Chinese ceramics, which Countess Rossi di Montelera left us, and I thought that was a good idea as well. And it was a great success. People enjoyed it.
Did you use anything from our national collection?
Absolutely. I used those magnificent soldier vases, as they're called, because they're very large, blue and white soldier vases, in, if I remember correctly, the ambassador's room at the palace in Valletta. I think it was President Fenech Adami at the time, and I asked him, and he said, no objections on my part, as long as Heritage Malta have no objections. And Heritage Malta were as happy as I was to display them and bring them over to Fort St. Angelo. I sometimes wonder if they had ever been moved out of the palace in Valletta before then.
Are there any other events or publications in the pipeline?
Well, that's another good question. Yes, I think there may be another in the pipeline, but
good.
I'm not going to tell you about it. I think it should be left as a surprise. Unfortunately, what blocks me at times are the tremendously high insurance premiums one has to pay nowadays, and of course I'm certainly not going to risk organizing an exhibition of anything precious or important without insuring everything. But to come back to exhibitions, you mentioned two of our exhibitions at St. Angelo. Actually, there were another two. One was called the Early Years of the Order in Malta. It was all connected with the donation of the island, the donation of the island by Charles V. And another one wasn't actually held at St. Angelo. We organized it at one of the auberges in Birgu, together with the local council of Birgu, and it was called Memories of the Order Conserved in Birgu. And this was organized together with the local council. And you'd be surprised how many things we found in Birgu which are connected in some way or other with the order. I remember borrowing La Valette sword from the parish church of St. Lawrence. And I remember the very friendly way in which the archpriest of the time said, if you want to borrow it, borrow it. And so I said, yeah, when can I come for it? How are we going to transport it? And he said, don't be silly, take it now. And we were walking in the main square of Virgo with La Valette sword in my hand.
But that's a testimony to the fact that you are trusted.
Well, no doubt about it. Trusted, but again, testimony to the only in Malta
yes,
way of doing things.
Also, it was only a street away.
Yes, it was only a very short distance away.
Is the order section at St. Angelo ever open to the public?
Since the big restoration works carried out by Heritage Malta, by the government of Malta, St. Angelo, or our section of Fort St. Angelo, has been open to the public on a daily basis since 2016. Actually, what happened is that when the big restoration works were finished, and of course during the big restoration works, the whole fort was closed to the public. How I survived, only God knows, but I survived.
You were practically insisted, living on a building, so...
Insisted on not moving out. And, yes, the moment they finished their works, we reached an agreement together, Heritage Malta on one hand, Fort St. Angelo on the other, SMOM on the other, to open our area of the fort to the public as well. And since then, it's been open to the public every day. So whenever Heritage Malta is open to the public, we are open to the public as well. Obviously, if we are organizing something in which we need our own premises, let's put it like that, we advise Heritage Malta in advance, they put it on their website, that on such and such a day, a certain section of the fort will not be accessible to them. But otherwise it is. We only had to close down for a few months during this pandemic because all museums were closed to the public, and that's all. Okay.
Rome is your second home, so St. Angelo is your first home, perhaps nowadays, but Rome is your second home, and naturally so, as the Order's international headquarters are based there. You are the curator of the art collections of the Order, and you're also extremely knowledgeable about the archives, which are in Rome. You were conservator of the archives. Can you give us an overview of what the Order's collection contains in terms of art and archives?
Well, to try and sort of summarize the Order's art collections and archives is going to be difficult, but I'll try. I gave a talk yesterday in connection with the President's Symposium on Diplomatic Cultural Affairs, very successful idea, I think, on the art collections of the Order, and I called it the Curator's Choice, because obviously I had little time available. And I divided my sort of what I was going to discuss into arguments, called paintings, tapestries, objects connected with the history of the Order, furniture, bronze, ceramics, and silver, and chose a few items from every category to give an example of what I was saying. The archives are, certainly we can't compare the archives we have in Rome with the archives we have in Malta. The National Archives in Malta. But we have interesting archives, mostly connected with correspondence between the government of the Order on the island and the Order's embassy in Rome, which was housed in Palazzo Malta, which is now the central seat of the Order, in Via Condotti. So there's a lot to explore, and many discoveries have been made during the years in which I was responsible for the archives, and since then, of course, as well.
So the bulk focuses on the 17th and 18th century?
The bulk is 18th century and 17th century, you're right. We have something older, we have something which somehow remained in our possession, or perhaps came to us through the archives of the Grand Priory of Rome, because the archives at the Grand Magistracy also, let's say, contain the archives, or what is left of the archives of the Grand Priory of Rome. But we have some documents which date back to pre-Malta times.
I see. What about the art collection? If you were to just mention one or two pieces, what are the star pieces of the collection?
Usually, my fellow knights, my brother knights in Rome, sometimes jokingly ask me if there were a fire in the palazzo, which work of art would you try and run out of the palace?
That's the wrong question I wouldn't ask Pascal Mancia.
I find it impossible to answer a question. I think I would choose the closest work of art to me and run out as soon as possible. But I have to mention a magnificent painting of the Holy Family by Ribera, by Lo Spagnoletto. I have to mention the portrait of a lady with a fan by Artemisia Gentileschi,
wow,
which is quite a masterpiece and is one of the objects which most museums in many countries of the world try to borrow. And
did you loan to the National Gallery?
We did. In fact, our Gentileschi was at the National Gallery only last year for the highly successful monographic exhibition there was about Artemisia Gentileschi. Not a difficult exhibition to organize. It was all through the pandemic and all that.
When did it come to the collection? Is it a recent acquisition or was
no,
it
the, the Artemisia Gentileschi came to us in the 1950s. In the 1950s, a member, actually two members of the Spinola family, the same Spinola family which we sometimes connect with Malta, with the palace in Valletta and the Palazzo Spinola in Spinola Bay, same family from Genoa. Two brothers, as I was saying, members of the order, left their town palace to the state, in other words, the palace in Genoa, and that was immediately converted into the National Museum for Genoa. And they left their country villa, which is situated between Rapallo and Santa Margherita Ligure, not very far from Genoa, of course, to the order, and with what it contained, again, so magnificent pieces even there, I mean. And yes, the Gentileschi came from there, but so did the François de Troyes, so did the Nicolas de l'Argilier, so did sculptures by Susini in bronze and from Florentine Renaissance.
So it's a considerable collection.
It's a considerable collection. I would say that the Spinola bequest in the 50s and the Rossi di Montelera bequest in the 80s were the most important collections.
This leads me to my next question. I know you're always very helpful, and in fact I remember contacting you as a student back in the early 2000s when I was researching my undergrad thesis, and you immediately helped me by sending me large prints of images of paintings that you have in the collection in Rome. Are these archives now accessible to scholars, or do we have to keep bothering you?
So your question, I think, can be divided in two parts. The first part is about your interest in views of the Grand Harbour. And I'm sorry you didn't come after that period, because since then I was working on the works of art at the seat of our Grand Priory of Bohemia, which is based in Prague, and I found so many other views of Malta there, which would have been very helpful to you at the time. At the time, I knew nothing about them.
Well, you certainly told me all you knew.
Absolutely. I certainly tried my best, and I still treasure the copy of your thesis you presented me with immediately after you had presented it yourself.
I'm very fond of that book.
Still a great help to me, actually.
I'm glad. But so, if we were to continue with the research, I mean, I know a lot of people out there are really interested in the history of the order and what the archives could contain that could lead to information for their own research subject. Are these archives accessible?
Yes, the archives in Rome, the order's archives in Rome, are accessible to the public. Not at the moment, because I believe the library and archives are being refurbished, and so everything has been placed into storage and all that. I think for another year at least, the archives will not be accessible. But then they will return being accessible. However, you mustn't think it's a bother if anyone contacts me. I can sort of act as go-between the budding scholar in Malta and our archives in Rome, and then it just goes ahead.
I can fully attest to that. However, the archives, if I'm not mistaken, have been digitized to a certain extent by the St. John's University,
yes,
which is based in Minnesota,
yeah,
through their Hill Monastic Manuscript Library. And quantity of them are now available online.
Yes, you're perfectly correct. And yes, it is possible to access the archives online. I don't know how much of the archives is online or not, but certainly a good quantity, a good amount.
We'll provide a link in the show
Absolutely.
Notes.
I find the archives especially fascinating at the moment for the proofs of nobility. We have large quantities of volumes, which are the bound proofs of nobility of knights seeking admission. Most of them are Italian knights, but fortunately this means that I recognize the name and study the family tree. And I probably know
the descendants of the family.
And often know the descendants, if there are any, yes. They're wonderful. They are works of art in themselves.
Indeed, they are very
beautifully illuminated. And
we're lucky to have so many of them in Malta and the National Library as well. So the order's headquarters in Rome are the Palazzo Malta, which is on the Via Condotti, and the Villa Malta on the Aventine Hill, which is perhaps the better known of the two, due to the famous keyhole at the gates, which permit one to look across the gardens at the distant view of St. Peter's. In the grounds is also the famous church, the Santa Maria del Priorato, which is Piranesi's only architectural work, so it's remarkable as an architectural monument in its own right. What are the functions of both buildings, the Villa Malta and the Palazzo Malta?
I'm glad you've mentioned Piranesi's Santa Maria del Priorato, because very recently we fully restored the chapel called Santa Maria del Priorato, church, because it's quite large, and it's certainly well worth another visit now. I mean, the stuccos are so beautifully cleaned and restored that quite a difference to what they looked like before, I mean, with centuries of dust which had accumulated and all that.
In 2013, we brought a group of Palazzo Falson friends of the museum to Rome, and we had visited the gardens of the Villa Malta, and you very kindly gave us access to the church as well.
I don't think it had been restored yet.
I don't believe so.
No, it's wonderful now, really, really wonderful. And I played a very important part in raising funds for that restoration. I'm very proud of that. Anyway, another part of your question is, how are these buildings used? I think you mentioned two properties. You mentioned the Aventine. Let's stick to the Aventine for now. And that's used as, first of all, the seat of our Grand Priory of Rome, and in part as our embassy to Italy.
I see.
The Palazzo Malta and Via Condotti, more austere, I mean, but people walk past those gates continually, and especially people from Malta look through the gates and immediately recognize the white eight-pointed cross over the fountain in the courtyard. That's the Grand Magistracy, that's the government of the order, the center of the order, the administrative center, the world headquarters of the order. The Aventine is open to the public on request. I'm afraid Palazzo Malta can't be open to the public because, okay, it's open to friends, let's say. Why not? If a friend phones and says, John, if you happen to be in Rome, can I bring a couple of friends over to see the palace? Why not? I'm happy to show them around. But we can't have it open to the public on the regular basis because it's where our offices are. It's where the Grand Master is walking around from one office to another to meet someone, to see someone. It's not such a large place. I mean, when you exclude the actual offices of secretaries and functionaries and dignitaries of the order, the state rooms are not so numerous.
And yet it has been in the order's possessions for several centuries. It's been in use for centuries.
Well, yes, it belonged to the Borzio family, and everyone knows Borzio for his history of the order. And then I think Borzio left it to his nephew, also agent of the order in Rome. So it's Giacomo Borzio and Antonio Borzio, the archaeologist. And then it was eventually left to the order, and it immediately became the home for the order's agent in Rome. At the time, they weren't called ambassadors, they were still called agents. Then another floor was added to it by De Villena. So it's been in our hands for about 400 years, yes, actually. In fact, we had some problems recently with the lands department, who wanted proof of possession or something like that. But then they finally accepted.
For that, you need a historian.
Our version, that's another story, yes.
And finally, a question that I just must ask you. Give us some inside information about Rome. Now, coming away from the most obvious artistic treasures of Rome, which is the one lesser known museum or site that we mustn't miss on our next trip to Rome? And why?
Difficult question for the Maltese especially, who seem to be sort of flying to Rome at every possible occasion. But there are two galleries I'd like to point out. One is called the Galleria Spada, and the other is called the Galleria Corsini. And they both contain magnificent collections of paintings and artworks and sculptures, and which people tend not to visit. I mean, the average visitor gets to the Galleria Doria Pamphili on Via del Corso. Someone a little more enthusiastic makes sure he's in Rome over the weekend to be able to visit Palazzo Colonna.
Saturday morning only,
which is again one of the immense treasures of Rome, really something incredible. But yes, I think perhaps on a future visit to Rome, those of you who haven't been, try and remember these two names. You'll find them on the websites, Galleria Spada and Galleria Corsini. First of all, they won't be as crowded as other museums are, and secondly, I think they'll be a surprise to you. There, you mentioned sites as well, besides museums. I think a site very close to another museum you should visit in Rome is the Keats Shelley Memorial House, alongside the Spanish Steps, alongside Trinità dei Monti. There you walk into history. You go back 200 years. I mean, you suddenly forget the crowds outside you in Piazza di Spagna, and you live through English Romanticism or the Romantic Age. A beautiful place, really beautiful place. Not very far from it, on the other side of the Scalinata, on the other side of the Trinità dei Monti, you have another shrine called Babington's Tea Rooms. I mean, and there again, it's almost funny when you walk into these tea rooms and you find yourself no longer in Rome, no longer in Italy, you're in England. You almost expect the two Babington sisters to come up and ask you, would you like a cup of tea or something like that. Wonderful place to have a cup of tea or an English morning breakfast.
I got more than I bargained for. Yeah. Thank you, Fra John. Thank you for your time with us, for being so generous with scholars, researchers, the people of Birgo, the people of Malta, and all who you encounter on a regular basis.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been great fun for me, first of all, seeing you after some time, I would say, and secondly, to be part of this program, which is worthy of great praise.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.